But that's just a great example. It's a picture that what's happening on the inside causes what's happening on the outside. And it's the big idea this weekend. You can write it in your notes. Outside conflict happens because of inside conflict. Jesus was raised in a family. He had a mom and a dad. He had brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, grandparents. He lived in a family. He was raised in a family. He had brothers and sisters. He knew all about what it was like to be in a family. And I'm sure that it was a conflict for his brothers and sisters, his parents, when Jesus would show up at school or tell people that he was the Messiah, the Christ. I mean, imagine if your brother or sister spread a rumor around that they were God, what it would be like for you. I mean, this was a family that had, you know, its share of stories, and people kind of thought, well, that family that lives in that house, their brother thinks he's God. You know, it caused some tension. One of his brothers was named James, and he doesn't buy it. I mean, Jesus tries to convince him that he's from heaven, that he's different from everybody else. And James is like, yeah, right. I played baseball with you before. That ball went right between your legs. You can't be God. You know, it's just he doesn't buy it. He doesn't get it. And it isn't until after the resurrection, until James finally sees that it isn't just something different about my brother. He really is the Messiah, the Christ. And he looks back on his life and his family situation. And he writes a book in the Bible. And in that book, he talks about conflict, and it's going to be the part of the Bible that we look at today. Let me read it to you. It's in your notes. What is causing the quarrels and fights among you? Now, you probably could answer that. We'll just stop right there. If someone were to come to you and say, what's causing the fights in your family and quarrels, you probably would have answer right away. Well, it's her. She never wants to have sex, or he always wants to have sex, or she won't go out and get a second job, or these kids won't listen to me even for a second, or, you know, he spends all the money, or she, you know, whatever. I mean, if somebody came to you right now and said, what's causing the conflicts in your family, you probably could answer it, and it probably wouldn't have anything to do with you. It'd be them. And James has a little different take on it. Let's hear what he has to say. What's causing the quarrels and fights among you? Don't they come from the evil desires at war within you? You want what you do not have, so you scheme and kill to get it. You're jealous of what others have, but you can't get it, so you fight and wage war to take it away from them. Yet you don't have what you want because you don't ask God for it. And even when you ask, you don't get it because your motives are all wrong. You want only what will give you pleasure. James, looking back on family, and you know, one of the problems is we all enter conflict differently. Different things bug us and bother us in families. And then once we're in conflict, we show up differently. Everybody tries to resolve conflict differently. They want their outside to be different. There's a different inside person. Jot in your notes. Here's one, the peacemaker. Maybe you have somebody in your family and they've appointed themselves. They're supposed to get everybody to get along. And they're always telling everybody to be quiet and just, you know, don't yell at them. And their job in the family is to get peace in the family. Here's the goal of the peacemaker. If we could just all get along, maybe we would care about each other. So you know, the problem with the peacemaker is they don't care about right and wrong. They don't care about ethics. They don't care about who's done what to who. All they care about is peace at any cost. They'll even allow people to be seriously wrong and make terrible decisions as long as there's peace. Now here's another one, the screamer. Maybe you grew up in a family where people yelled and screamed and, you know, whenever a conflict started, they'd just ramp it up. And by the way, no elbowing in church today. We don't want any conflicts in this room. So, you know, but you grew up as a screamer, someone that yelled. The minute the conflict broke out, the minute it started to emerge, their voice went up and up and up, and they started yelling and yelling and yelling. And people that yell, I've noticed, they don't even like know they're yelling and screaming because they're screaming at you, and you say, listen, don't raise your voice, stop yelling. And then they say, I'm not yelling! They're like louder when they say that. You know, here's why people scream. It's the cry of their heart. Don't make me uncomfortable. Don't take me out of my comfort zone. So they're screaming and yelling, don't take me out of my comfort zone. Don't take me out. And because they scream and yell, they make other people so uncomfortable so they can be comfortable. And here's the problem with it. When I scream and I yell and I get you to back off, which people usually do because they don't want to be yelled at, and so they back off, and the person's like, oh, still in my comfort zone. And so they think the screaming works because I'm comfortable. And yet at some point in their life, there's this nagging realization that they don't feel close to anybody. They feel comfortable, but not close. Because everybody walks on eggshells. And everybody avoids making them yell. Screamers, yellers, we have them in our families. The stuffer. Now this person is the stuffer. The stuffer never says, just the opposite of the screamer, the stuffer never says anything. They just stuff everything down inside. They never say a word about anything. The stuffer. And now, it's not that they don't have an opinion. Stuffers have lots of opinions. They have lots of judgments. They never speak it. Here's why. Their goal is, I don't want to get in trouble. I'm not going to say anything. I don't want to cause a problem. I don't want to get in trouble. So they stuff it, and they stuff it, and they stuff it, and they stuff it. But they have opinions and judgments, but they're silent. I've discovered some of the most judgmental people are the stuffers. They never say anything. So their judgments never come out. And their judgments are never tested. The stuffer always thinks they're right because their judgments are never tested by anybody else. And they just keep stuffing and stuffing and stuffing. It's kind of like I brought a little illustration today. So here's the stuffer right here. They just keep stuffing it and stuffing it and stuffing it. And they have opinions, but they don't say it. And they have judgments, and they never share it. And they're just stuffing it like this, and it just goes down and down and down and down. And, you know, and here's what it looks like with the stuffer. That's what they look like at the family gatherings. The picture of patience and calm. And nobody realizes that for the last 2 or 3 years, they've just been stuffing everything down. They wanted to say something, but they didn't get it. You know, I'll get in trouble if I do. And they just... And that's what they look all the time. And then every once in a while, the stuffer just blows their cork. And everybody around them is like, gosh, that's not like them. And the stuffer will usually lose it at the wrong time with the wrong person over the wrong thing. Because they've been stuffing about 100 things. And then finally, I just play it. Okay, we all know, huh? The stuffer. Okay, the sulker. Now, the sulker, I understand the sulker because when I was a kid, I was the sulker. The sulker, I got a little picture for you of the sulker. You can see there's the sulker. When I was a kid, write this down in your notes. The sulker, here's the goal of the sulker. If I can get you to feel bad enough, you'll give me my way. So they got the big pouty face. And they just sulk around the house because they didn't get to go out and play. They had to help it with the dishes. Sulkers. One time with my grandparents, I stayed in there for the summer. I wanted to go play with my buddies outside. And they told me I couldn't. Dinner was going to be coming soon. You know, you can't go out and play. I sulked and sulked and sulked. And finally, this is the ultimate sulk. I went into the back part of the house. And I crawled underneath the bed and I hid there. And I thought, they're going to be looking for me when dinner comes. And they're not going to be able to find me. And they're going to think I ran away. And then they'll feel bad. So I crawled underneath the bed. And I'm under there for a little while. And nobody's coming to look for me. I'm under there a little longer and longer and longer. I'm starting to get hungry. And it's dark underneath. I'm like, they're not even coming. So I get out from underneath the bed, and I could hear him down in the kitchen. And I crept down the hallway, and there was this spot in the hallway where he could get right next to an open area in the kitchen and listen. I thought, they're probably in there scared, calling the police, worried about me. And I listened, they're in there having a party. They weren't even talking about me. They're not even worried about me. See, the sulker thinks everybody's concerned about them. When I sulk, everybody's concerned about me. Newsflash, they're not even thinking about you. It doesn't work. Here's the last one, is the lawyer. This is my current mode of operation that I use, the litigator. Now, the lawyer turns the whole world into a courtroom when there's a conflict. The lawyer always presents his case And maybe you live with someone like that. They're so smart, and they're very verbal, and they're always right, and they have this like tight, watertight case on why things should be exactly like they should see them to be. Here's the goal of the lawyer. If I win, I'm important, and maybe someone will care about me. And so they're always like slicing and dicing, and they're the lawyer, and you feel cornered, and you're backed up. And here's the problem with the lawyer. They win a lot of cases, and they lose a lot of relationships. Because as they're building their case and they're making their claims, lawyers are usually very insensitive to other people's feelings and perspectives. And some people are like, yeah, you are so dead right. And our relationship is too. Now, how do you operate? Who are you married to? And I don't know why sulkers often marry screamers. I don't know why this thing gets all mixed up. And why do peacemakers, you know, why do they end up with someone that wants to scream all the time? I mean, but it happens. What are your kids like? How do they operate? What were your parents like? What kind of family did you grow up in? And by the way, none of these are bad. This is just how we operate. And James is saying, if you can get Jesus in the middle of it, you can have something different. Here's what it looks like, right? Number one, we play the blame game. Blaming each other. You want what you don't have, so you scheme and kill to get it. Oh, pretty strong language. I don't know that anybody's plotting murder. But here's what James is saying. Sometimes I want something so bad, to get it, I'll hurt the person that I love the most. I remember the first time I made my wife cry. I didn't make her cry the entire time that we were dating. And I didn't make her cry the entire time we were engaged. And I didn't make her cry on the honeymoon. And about a month after we got married, we're in our little apartment, and I'm the lawyer, and I'm backing her into a corner over something, and I'm presenting my case to her, and I'm just thinking, I'm just about ready to win. Any minute, the judge is going to put the gavel down. And she started sobbing. And through her sobs, she said, I'm out of here. She started heading for the door. And I remember that just so clearly, two emotions. The first emotion was, I win. And here was the second one. Wait a minute. I didn't marry Clarice to make her cry. I was a young man. I remember stepping back and going, wait a second. What's going on here? The blame game. I want something so bad, I'll hurt someone that I love so much. Blaming them. Holding them responsible. It's on the outside. James has a different take. He says, no, it's on the inside. It's about you. Now, I'm not saying you can't hold someone accountable for something. Blame and accountability is entirely different. Sometimes you have to hold someone accountable for something, but if you are going to hold them accountable, it has to be something they agreed to. I have young couples come to me all the time, and the girls say, well, I'm just trying to hold him accountable for being a sensitive husband that's willing to listen. And he's like, well, I'm just trying to hold her accountable for how she spends money. You know, and as we have the conversation a little more, I realize neither of them have agreed to anything. Have you ever tried to hold anybody accountable for something that they have not agreed to do? Let's say, for instance, you're in your neighborhood and your neighbor told you a couple weeks ago, I'm going to put this big rock wall in my backyard. You know, oh, yeah, great. You know, and you come out, you know, Friday night, you get home, and there's this like 15-foot pile of river rock, you know, 4 feet high in front of his house, you know. You're like, oh, man, that's a lot of rock, you know. You go to bed, you get up in the morning. Sure enough, early in the morning, you look out. There he is, wheelbarrow gloves, loading up this wheelbarrow, you know, and taking these rocks down the side. At that moment, you're like, I'm glad I paid someone to do my yard job. But anyways, he's, you know, and 9:30, knock on the door. Knock, 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 knock. You open up the door, there's your neighbor, covered with sweat. And you say, hey, man, when are you going to be over here to help me with these rocks? You're like, huh? What do you mean? The rocks, man. When are you going to come and help me? I'm just holding you accountable for being a good neighbor. Like, hey, man, I don't know what your definition is. My definition of good neighbor is I don't let my dog crap on your front yard. That's as far as I go. The first thing that comes to your mind is, well, I didn't ever agree to that. Do you know husbands do it to wives, wives do it to husbands, parents do it to children, children do it to parents. They hold them accountable for things they never agreed to. That's not accountability. Accountability is when you talk. You make an agreement with one another. And once you have an agreement, then you go to someone and say, wait a minute, man. Now you told me you'd be at my house at 9:30. I'm not trying to bust your chops, but I need some help. And you said you would. That's fair. Agreement. But we blame for things that nobody ever agreed to do. We blame because we hold other people responsible for what I want. This isn't your notes, but write this sentence down. As long as you blame others for your unhappiness, you'll never be happy. As long as you blame others for your unhappiness, you'll never be happy. I was on Facebook the other day. I saw this old kid I grew up with. He was a few years older than me, but I used to run around with him. And he was commenting on this other kid that recently became a firefighter. And in his Facebook post, he put, I wish my parents would have supported me so I could have been that. And he's an old man now. I wish my parents would. And I, as soon as I read that, I thought to myself, wait a second, man. I knew you when you were a kid. You didn't want your parents' support. You did everything in your world to lie to your parents so they didn't know what you were doing. That's not fair. You can't blame them for what you don't have. It was your choice. And James is saying good news. Because it doesn't work, you don't have to live that way. You do not have to live in blame. There's a better way. Number two in your notes, your family's not responsible for your happiness. Here's the key. This is the whole thing. Price of admission today, right here, this verse. Seek your happiness in the Lord. Circle it. Seek your happiness in the Lord. Circle it. Seek your happiness in the Lord, not your wife, not your job, not what your body looks like, not your bank account, not how long or short her legs are, none of that. Seek your happiness in the Lord, not your child. In the Lord. Seek your happiness in the Lord and you'll have the desires of your heart. But we put it on our wife and our husband and our children and our parents. You know, when you learn to turn to Jesus for whatever it is, you don't have to hold other people responsible for things they could never accomplish. When we learn to take it to God, we don't have to hold other people responsible for something they were never designed to accomplish. Your husband's not your savior. Your wife is not your God. They weren't designed for that. Happiness in the Lord. Your bank account will never make you feel secure enough. Your job will never make you feel important enough. Seek your happiness in the Lord. And I understand. I was an unchristian for a long time in my life. I understand. Like, if I can't turn to God and I don't have anything with Him, I understand. Understand why I make other people responsible for my happiness. When I'm unhappy, where else am I supposed to turn? Of course I'm going to blame other people. I don't want to blame myself. I already feel bad about myself. Understand that. One of the reasons we turn to Him is to have something different. You don't have to earn that. I heard this great analogy the other day. It had to do with the voice. And that's that cool show where they come out and come on stage and they sing a song. And it's interesting because, you know, you've seen it probably. All the chairs that they're in, these big seats, are turned away from them. So you can't see the person singing. So they come out and all the chairs are facing that direction. Nobody can see. And you come out and you sing your song or whatever it is you do. And then if they like you, if they accept you, if they want you on their team, they hit a button, I guess, and their chair spins around. Well, of course, you know. I mean, can you imagine if you qualified for The Voice and you made it all the way there and now it's your time to go out on stage, and just before you go, you stop and you just say a prayer. You say, God, I am so nervous. Win or lose, please be with me. And you feel something different. And as you walk out on the stage, just before the music starts, you walk out on stage and you face them. There's all the seats, there's four of them. They're all faced the other direction. All you can see is the back. And just before you start, all four of them spin around. And the sign comes up. I want you. I want you. I want you. I want you on my team. Before you did anything, they chose you. Before you sang a note, they picked you. Before you did anything great, or before you flopped, the chair spun around. And that's the picture. Here, it's in the last part, the bottom line. Peace on the inside creates peace on the outside. Can you imagine how you would sing your song if you sang it after all four chairs spun around? How different your life would be? If you weren't waiting to see if they accepted you and wanted you and picked you for the team, can you imagine how you would sing your song? Can you imagine how you could live your life if you were already chosen, God already picked you? Listen, let me read it to you. Do not be anxious about anything. Instead, pray about everything. Tell God what you need and thank Him for all He's done. Then you will experience God's peace, which exceeds anything you can understand. His peace will guard your hearts and minds as you live in Jesus Christ. And write in, pray about the problem.